From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, 2 years in the gutter with Al Gore and George W. Bush. We talk with Dana Milbank about his observations on the campaign trail. It's the subject of his new book, Smash Mouth. Milbank is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new reality-based shows, The Mole, which premiered on ABC last night, and Temptation Island, which premieres tonight on Fox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A group of voting rights advocates filed suit against the state of Florida today, charging officials there with violating the Voting Rights Act during last November's election. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The dimpled chads and butterfly ballots got most of the attention as George W. Bush and Al Gore contested the results of the election in Florida. But African Americans have long contended there were many other serious problems suffered by black voters. There were hundreds of complaints alleging substandard voting equipment in black communities, large numbers of registered voters purged from the rolls, and other voters turned away. Dennis Hayes is general counsel of the NAACP.
In Florida precincts where there were a substantial number of black voters, there were a disproportionate number of ballots where no votes were counted for the office of President of the United States.
The suit seeks to force Florida to comply with the Voting Rights Act. It would bar the use of punch card voting systems and order better training for poll workers. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush's nominee for Education Secretary got a warm reception today at his confirmation hearing. Both Republicans and Democrats praised Rod Page's record as superintendent of schools in Houston, where he was credited with raising academic standards and test scores. Senate Democrats asked Page about his support for school vouchers, which would provide taxpayer assistance for some students to attend private schools. Page responded that vouchers weren't his top priority and said that he's only trying to find what works. A New Hampshire lawmaker who advocates killing police officers has resigned from the state legislature. New Hampshire Public Radio's Josh Rogers reports from Concord.
Tom Alsier provided a resignation letter, but no explanation. The move comes a week into the legislative session and 10 days after Alsier's 1,000-odd internet posting supporting violence against police officers became widely known. New Hampshire House Speaker Gene Chandler says Alsier did the right thing and did it without coercion from House leaders.
It was a decision that he made independently, certainly, and one that he felt was in his best interest and his family's and his constituents and the whole House of Representatives, I think. So he has submitted his resignation, and we've accepted it.
Alsier had been urged to step down by police groups, fellow lawmakers, the state GOP, and the governor. A primary to fill Alsier's seat could be held as soon as March 13th with a general election in April. For NPR News, I'm Josh Rogers in Concord, New Hampshire.
American Airlines has agreed to buy the assets of the bankrupt TWA for about $500 million. The deal marks the end of the pioneering TWA name. TWA officials said the deal calls for American to offer jobs to most of its 20,000 employees. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 32 points to close at 10,604 in heavy trading. This is NPR News from Washington. Police in Northern California say they're looking for a gunman or gunmen who killed at least three people and wounded two others. Sheriff's officials say two people were shot to death in a county building in Nevada City, and a manager was killed at a local restaurant. Investigators are still uncertain whether the same gunman was responsible for both killings. Two new giant pandas were introduced to the public today at the National Zoo in Washington. NPR's Marianne Akers reports.
Meisheng and Qian Qian had been in quarantine for 30 days since their arrival, but they seemed unfazed when the covering around their exhibit was removed. The pandas lumbered down as close as they could get to a visiting group of schoolchildren. They sat up on their hind legs and stared back at the humans, gracefully nibbling on bamboo. The secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, Lawrence Small, introduced the duo.
I don't think since there was a pair like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers have we seen a more nimble couple than this one, and I'm just thankful that they don't yet have an agent, because I don't know what we'd have to pay if they did.
The National Zoo is renting the male and female pandas, paying China $1 million a year over 10 years. The money is supposed to go toward panda conservation efforts in China, where as few as 1,000 giant pandas remain. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Express will soon begin delivering packages for the U.S. Postal Service. The deal was announced today by FedEx's chairman and the Postmaster General. They said FedEx will use its planes to carry as much as 3.5 million pounds of packages a day for the post office. In return, FedEx will get the right to put its boxes in post offices all over the country. The company and the Postal Service say they'll continue to compete in all other aspects of the business. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from SmartMoney.com, financial advice, analytical tools, and coverage of the financial world. On the web at SmartMoney.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A treatise on political toilet humor is how Dana Milbank describes his new book, Smash Mouth. It's about what he observed during his 2 years on the presidential campaign trail. Milbank is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Starting with the primary, he spent time with each of the candidates, from Gore, Bush, McCain, and Bradley, to Gary Bauer and Alan Keyes. Milbank's title, Smash Mouth, is his variation on trash mouth politics, the expression George W. Bush used to describe negative campaigning. Milbank celebrates in-the-gutter campaigning, but more about that later. I spoke with Milbank yesterday and asked if he thought that Gore, Bush, or their campaign teams behaved differently during the Florida aftermath than they did during the campaign.
It was a situation of they behaved like they had done during the campaign, only more so. The Bush folks all along were very tight with the information. They were very guarded. They were extremely loyal to their candidate. The Gore folks were more sort of the cool professionals. They loved to talk. They loved to leak. They loved to, you know, schmooze with reporters and go out for drinks and dinner and that sort of thing. During the campaign and during the aftermath of the campaign, it became outrageous. You couldn't actually get a hold of the Bush people. They just locked themselves up in this building in Tallahassee. The telephones were on an answering machine, or if you finally got somebody, you'd leave a message for somebody else who wouldn't return the call. I actually went over there to the office and just tried to walk in, and there's a big sign, keep out, on the door. You just couldn't, and then you'd call people in Austin, you couldn't get anybody there. So it reinforced their earlier instincts. And of course, the Gore people were out there spinning like crazy. They were out with for drinks and dinner and lunch every day and night. They had masterful stories to tell. Unfortunately, it wasn't so much a matter of keeping up public opinion. They succeeded in doing that, but apparently the U.S. Supreme Court wasn't buying their spin on that one.
What do you prefer, the aide to take you out for dinner and spin for hours, or the aides that lock the door and put up a sign saying, keep out?
Well, of course, we like to go to dinner, and that way we can bill our editors with large expense accounts. There's something to be said for the Bush style as well, and they're continuing that in the White House now. They're trying to create this whole leak-free environment, which would be a first ever in Washington. I don't think they're actually going to achieve that, but at the moment they more or less have achieved that, so that no newspaper or network is really getting a scoop now. So on the one hand, it's frustrating that I'm not getting that scoop for the Washington Post. On the other hand, it's nice to know that I'm not going to get a call from my editor in the middle of the night saying the New York Times got a scoop. I don't think that'll last very long, because I think the Washington culture is going to change the Bush people more than the Bush people are going to change Washington. I suspect they know that too, and ultimately they'll have to acquiesce to the system here.
You know, the impulse a lot of people have when they see a campaign or a new president cutting off communication with the press is, what are they trying to hide? Is that what you're wondering? What are they trying to hide? Or do you think it's about something else?
I think it's based on a long-term experience. All new administrations pretty much are hostile to the press. The Clinton administration did this and got into a great deal of trouble for it. So I can't really blame them for doing it. It's not that I suspect they're trying to hide something. I suspect they believe that they can control information the way they controlled information during the campaign, and probably the way Bush controlled information when he was governor of Texas. What they don't realize is that they're creating a great deal of hostility needlessly. It's not that reporters are sitting there, you know, demanding to know in advance of everybody else who the Secretary of State's going to be or the Secretary of Defense. The way it comes out for the Bush folks is almost a contempt for the press. You can sometimes see it even when he's speaking on TV, the way he'll glare at a member of the press corps, or he'll just have impatience for the questions being asked. And as journalists, we see it with his staff, too. They generally treat us as the enemy, somebody to be avoided. You speak to them only when necessary. The problem with this is they're creating quite a bit of ill will. And when things get rough, they're not going to have a whole lot of friendship and goodwill in the press corps. Now, you can see the whole McCain situation was the opposite. The journalists just fell in love with John McCain, and I do not believe it's because journalists fell in love with his policies. It's because he let us talk to him on his bus. He fed us donuts. He fed us barbecue. All his staff members talked to us and told us the inside dope. Everything was clear and everything was transparent, and a journalist gave John McCain a hell of a ride because of that. He was given a lot more coverage and quite a big boost in the free media than he probably should have gotten. And I think Bush took a page from that book after McCain beat him in New Hampshire, but then he quickly, after he triumphed in the primaries, he returned to his earlier format, and that's what he remains in now. But I think ultimately that McCain lesson is something that other politicians are going to have to pick up, or at least I hope they do.
Well, do you think Bush would have a harder time picking up on that lesson because of the verbal gaffes that he makes and because he sometimes seems more insecure in his knowledge?
He does when you see him in public. That's why he's a great schmoozer. When he comes back on the airplane, everybody loves him. He wants to talk baseball. He's got a nickname for everybody. He's like everybody's uncle. He's this friendly fellow. He knows a little bit about everything. He loves to talk about fishing. You can't stump him on some sort of sports trivia. That's where he's at his most comfortable, and often he's doing this off the record. So it's even if he makes some sort of one of his delightful malaprops, you won't report it anyway. The time when he's awkward and we get the deer in the headlights is when he's doing a press conference, and that's when the journalists are doing the sort of gotcha idea of trying to stump him with the name of some world leader, or trying to quiz him on some question that he hadn't been briefed on, and which causes he sort of flips through the file cards in his mind looking for the right one and reading a little bit of each of them, realizing he doesn't have the answer to this particular question.
What do you think Bush's cabinet selection process is revealing about the kind of leader that he is?
Well, it reveals the good and the bad about him as a leader. The amazing thing is it was done in about 20 days, even with this time-shortened post-election period. And he balanced his party in an extraordinary way to make the conservatives happy, the moderates reasonably happy. He did this by approaching it as a businessman, as if he were selecting a board of directors for the Texas Rangers. He'd assigned people to think about this more than a year ago. They'd solicited a great amount of input, but they held the decision-making very close. No information leaked out. Only a few people ultimately made the decision, did it very quickly and very efficiently. Now, as we've seen earlier this week, this can also create problems because you skip over a lot of the vetting of potential nominees. Bush was assuming that a lot of these folks, because they'd been in government earlier, they'd been senators or whatnot, their records had pretty much been pawed through already. Now we've found out in the case of Linda Chavez that obviously wasn't true, and there's this whole thing is sort of blown up on them. So there's a flip side to that as well. He's very efficient. He's very quick and decisive, but when you're efficient, quick, and decisive, and you also have a small number of aides whom you place your trust in, and without casting out to a wider range of people, it magnifies the possibility for a mistake, and that appears to be what had happened here.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dana Milbank. He's a White House correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book Smash Mouth, Notes from the 2000 Campaign Trail. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dana Milbank. He's a White House correspondent for The Washington Post, a former senior editor for The New Republic. He's written a new book about covering the 2000 presidential campaign. It's called Smash Mouth. You spent 2 years covering the presidential campaign. What would you say were the best and worst parts for you as a reporter covering the campaign?
Well, the best parts for me as a reporter were the parts that probably wouldn't make the news columns. There was that brief and glorious moment when Donald Trump appeared to be running for president. So we took a whole bunch of reporters on his 727 with the mirrored headboard over the bed and in the cabin with the impressionist paintings on the wall. He passed out Trump 2000 little individual bottles of Purell, the hand cleaner, because he was famous for not wanting to shake hands because of the germs that would be spread. He was flying all over California, theoretically drumming up interest in his campaign. In reality, he was selling a book that he'd just put out, and he was taking us all to motivational conferences that he'd already agreed to speak at. But that was, to me, that was the perhaps the most delightful moment in it. The reason being, we all took Donald Trump seriously, that he could actually, he was wanting to run against Pat Buchanan for the Reform Party. Donald Trump has a lot of money, and anybody who has a lot of money in politics today is automatically taken as a serious candidate, even if he's Donald Trump with the mirrored headboard in the cabin of his 727.
And the low part of covering the campaign?
Well, there's many of those to choose from. I think what I really can't stand is the press hoard, and there's no way around it because with all the 24-hour media coverage, all the internet stations and the cable television stations. There are just so many of us. But the one that really sticks to mind is when we all went up on George Bush's first campaign swing. We all went up to the family home at Walker Point in Kennebunkport, Maine. There were probably 200, 250 of us there, a lot of them carrying cameras and microphones. We're all standing there like cattle outside of the gate. This man, our shepherd, as it turns out, gets up and starts with rather foul language, starts telling us exactly how we're going to walk across the lawn to meet, to get this quick photo op with the former president and the candidate. We literally started mooing as if we were cattle, which we felt that we were at that point. This would repeat itself throughout the campaign. I mean, picture the going to cover a presidential debate. My newspaper, I think, sent 8-10 people to these debates both in the primaries and in the general election. Everybody who's anybody wants to be at covering these presidential debates. In reality, all we do is sit in some sort of warehouse 100 yards away from the debate site and watch it on TV. Essentially, we're doing the same thing everybody's doing at home, only less comfortably because we're all stuffed into this warehouse.
But then, don't you try to collar the campaign aides and get
right,
their spin?
Right. It becomes the spin room, which is it's perhaps even more demeaning. This for all sides. So it sort of the climax of this is at the end when these junior aides come out with little picket signs and it'll say something like Shalala on one, and there's Donna Shalala walking after it like he's selling a product. In reality, he's selling Donna Shalala. So to see if she wants to say.
And then what do you do, like take a number and wait for your turn to talk to her?
Well, Donna Shalala is not hard to get. You see, what you really want, you know, I mean,
right.
Sorry to say that, but what you really want to get is, you know, you want to get the campaign chairman or you want to get like Karl Rove, the chief strategist of Bush. You don't really want the Veterans Affairs Secretary or something. So sometimes you'll see this guy sort of, the kid holding up the sign, and he'll look sort of forlorn, And then, you know, somebody from Japanese television or something will go over and interview this guy, assuming he's the Secretary of State, and not really having any idea who he is.
Now, you switch back and forth between candidates during the campaign. Some reporters stay with one candidate and follow them through from start to finish. Do you think there are advantages of switching back and forth between the candidates?
Well, sure. There are advantages to both ways. The ones who stick with a particular candidate really get to know this fellow and get to know his staff extremely well. So, for example, those covering Bush are now in a very good position to cover his White House because they know all these people very well and because all of these people wound up are winding up coming to the White House. The primary advantage is a selfish one. The boredom just isn't there. I mean, picture these the poor folks covering these guys. Some of them were covering Bush, I think, for 15 months. Essentially inside the bubble, as they say. You're going from bus to plane to another bus to an event site to a filing center. At each point, you know, food is brought into you. You don't actually go out into the outside world, you know, or if you do, you know, you see a 7-Eleven across the street and you quickly go over there to get an orange juice or something like that. So it's a terrible sort of form of captivity, and you can't leave because you might miss something. And if he's going to five cities in a day, you cannot do it on your own because there's no way to keep up. So it was a great advantage to me just to be able to hop in for a few days and, you know, and say see you later when they moved on to the next state. The other advantage was getting to compare the campaigns and get a sense of what they were like other than word of mouth. And there was a huge difference between the campaigns this time. There was sort of the sanctimonious Bradley campaign. There was the lockstep Bush campaign. There was the freewheeling McCain campaign. And there was the Gore campaign with this rather delightful and comical staff and a candidate who was quite the opposite. So I enjoyed covering them for that reason. But you got to see, and of course, you know, you got to spend a little time with Gary Bauer. You got to try to get close to Alan Keyes if his bodyguards wouldn't get in the way, and you got to see all these others also rans who you never had a chance of winning, but make it a whole spirited competition, and that's what makes it worthwhile.
You used to write for the New Republic, and now you're with the Washington Post. Compare the kind of reception you get from politicians and from their aides writing for the Washington Post versus the New Republic.
Yeah, I've seen that. And earlier, I worked for the Wall Street Journal, which people perceive to be a conservative publication because of its editorial page. The New Republic people perceive as a liberal publication, which it is. And the Washington Post is seen as vaguely left of center, but mostly a sort of a mainstream thing. I had the additional complication working at the New Republic in that the owner of the New Republic, Marty Peretz, is a very close friend of Al Gore's and was one of Gore's college professors. So the critics, the conservative critics particularly, would call it the Gore Republic. They called me Marty Peretz's butt boy, just, you know, doing whatever he said to write about Al Gore. Reality was never that way, but reality didn't really matter. It was just the perceptions out there, and even the other reporters would joke, "When am I going to get my staff pin for the Gore campaign?" That kind of thing. The Bush side didn't react very well to me originally at all. I remember the first time one of the Bush's aides tried to introduce me to him. They said, "This is Dana Milbank." He said, "Oh, hello, and who are you with?" And I said, "The New Republic," and he immediately says, "Oh, great," and then. And then the aide said, but before that, he was with the Wall Street Journal. But it was of no use, and he walked away. I tried many times to get an interview with Bush during the time I was with the New Republic. And each time they'd sort of tease and promise that I'd be, okay, it would be on the next trip. And then you'd get a call at the last minute. Whoops, the schedule just happened to fill up. Wouldn't you know it? So I kept pressing on. I was getting hostile about getting interview time. At one point, I threatened to carry a sign that just said, "Governor Bush, talk to me." And I'd gotten the TV networks and the newspaper people interested in actually covering this. So I think in retrospect, I'm glad I decided not to do that. It would have been sort of, you know, trying to become like the Michael Moore of campaign coverage, which might have made my current job a little bit more difficult. And sure enough, you get to the Washington Post and suddenly that schedule cleared up. And we did have a couple of sit-down interviews and they went very well and there didn't seem to be any hard feelings.
No, in your book, Smash Mouth, you write that you want to celebrate the virtues of good, solid, in-the-gutter campaigning. Explain what you mean.
Well, I actually take an example that's going on right now. As soon as the Gore conceded and Bush won the election, everybody started talking about we need to be bipartisan, we've got to work together, we've got to work in the American people's interests, and blah, blah, blah. I would submit that that was the most dishonest moment of the last year, because nobody meant that for one second. You're seeing that all unravel right now as the Democrats get ready to attack Bush's nominees, as Bush went ahead and selected a conservative cabinet without consulting with the Democrats, and now he's threatening to take his tax cut and his education plan and everything else to Congress without any concessions to the Democrats. It was the same notion during the campaign. Is the most dishonest time is when the candidates are saying what a decent and good man their opponent is, and how they really think we should be taking the high road in this campaign and avoiding personal attacks and negative politics. That in itself became a form of negative politics. You'd say, oh, well, I'm taking the high road, but my opponent is just attack, attack, attack. And the truth is, I think that Americans like negative politics the same way Americans would rather watch football than go to the ballet. If you look at strictly numbers of Americans who would pursue one of those two activities, we like conflict. And further, it's not only that it's a necessary thing in politics, but that it's a good thing in politics, because ideas, the clash of ideas in the marketplace is how we resolve things. Let's throw everything in there. Let's let our different ideas clash, and let's make a compromise, or let the best idea win. It's not all about being nice to each other and minimizing our differences and pretending that we're all bipartisan, we all think the same thing. So I think it is healthy for our system to have this kind of smash mouth politics during the campaigns and while governing.
Dana Milbank is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book about life on the campaign trail is called Smash Mouth. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John McCain's barbecue, Bill Bradley's lectures, and Karen Hughes' shoes. We continue our talk with journalist Dana Milbank about his 2 years covering the presidential campaign. And David Bianculli reviews two new reality-based TV shows, The Mole and Temptation Island.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dana Milbank, a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book, Smash Mouth, is about his 2 years on the presidential campaign trail. You were covering John McCain during part of the period of his Straight Talk Express, the bus that he traveled on in which reporters were invited to travel with him and talk with him. Now, you say in your book that the idea of Straight Talk Express was really the idea of one of his aides who decided that media access could compensate for the lack of money in the McCain campaign. Talk a little bit more about what they were hoping the media access would give to the McCain campaign.
Sure. Well, in political campaigns, they talk of two types of media. There's paid media, which is advertising, and then there's earned media. They don't like to say free media because they do think they're earning it, and in a sense, they're right. They are earning it. John McCain knew he was going to be vastly outspent by Bush, who would early on raise $36 million, then it was up to $70 million, and McCain had somewhere between a tenth and a quarter of that. So McCain had the idea that with his lower budget that he could overcome this by bringing journalists onto this bus. This was the brainchild of John Weaver, who was one of this sort of eccentric fellow who was McCain's top strategist. And they said, all right, you know, it's going to be a high wire act. It may wind up embarrassing John McCain. He may say things that he regrets that'll cause the whole thing to blow up on him. In fact, that happened a couple of times during the campaign. But they figured, on balance, it's just going to generate story after story every day. The press is going to fall in love with this guy because we're all so used to being treated as vermin by political candidates in both parties. And I think they were very much correct in that. Now, when Bush got tough in the end in South Carolina, the media didn't, to some extent, stood up for McCain and ultimately abandoned him in the end. One of McCain's advisors, Mike Murphy, said it's being nice to the media is like making love with scorpions, and you just never know when they might sting you. He was right about that, but you got to think of the tremendous amount of coverage this guy got. He was at 3% in the polls in New Hampshire and wound up winning that primary, and a lot of that just had to do with the relentless coverage he was getting and the relentlessly good coverage that he was getting. It was partially because of some issues, say campaign finance reform, which a lot of people in the press, because we see this stuff every day, are very enthusiastic about. But it's because he spoke candidly and openly, and the fact that he just spoke to us at all. I was very impressed with McCain on election night in New Hampshire. There was a whole group of reporters, obviously hundreds, there to cover the official celebration. But he let a few of us come up and into his hotel suite where his family was and a few of his close aides. And just we were all, you know, sort of sipping a cocktail or whatever and watching this candidate as the election returns came in, which is, it's really unheard of. You have photo ops that sort of capture that for a moment. But here was a guy actually showing us everything. It generated such unbelievable free media or earned media that I think McCain was able, until the very end, to keep up with George Bush.
Did you feel used, or do you just kind of accept the fact that, of course, politicians are going to try to use the press? That's the way the game is played, and it's your job to just write what you observe and, you know, be as honest. And
This may not speak very well for the journalistic profession, but I don't think that we mind being used. It was just so pleasant to have somebody actually paying attention to us. Mm-hmm. And that's what it strikes me is it's actually so easy for these candidates to get good coverage. The debate goes back and forth. Is there a liberal bias in the media? Or during this campaign, it seemed the coverage on Gore was the toughest. So it was almost the flip side. Was there some sort of conservative bias? Individual reporters may have such biases. I think the thing that overrides all of this is your personal feelings about the candidate, and that is something that's just so easy to change and to mold, as McCain showed us, as Bush showed us when he chose to show us. I did a whole chapter in my book is about the quality of the food that is served to journalists on the campaign trail. We're in this bubble. We're captive. The campaign's figured out that if you actually feed the press regularly and with good food, particularly starchy and sugary food that will cause you to get sleepy, you're going to have a more content press corps. And I mean, it was partially tongue-in-cheek what I wrote there, but I think there is some truth to that. We're actually a fairly simple organisms, and we will write good stories for food.
My guest is Washington Post White House correspondent Dana Milbank. His new book, Smash Mouth, is about his 2 years on the presidential campaign trail. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dana Milbank is my guest. He's a White House correspondent for The Washington Post and the author of a new book about covering the presidential campaign, and that book is called Smash Mouth. You are covering Bill Bradley on a day that he gave a speech about meaning in American politics, and a bunch of people in the audience, you say, fell asleep, including Father Ted Hesburgh, the president emeritus of the university where Bradley was speaking. Did you report on that in The Washington Post, that people were sleeping?
No, that was before I came to the Post, so that was from one of my early magazine stories. But so yes, I did write about it at the time, and that's one of those delightful things that just sort of drops into your lap. I went to see the speech because that was essentially all that Bradley was doing. This was in late 98, so very, very early in the campaign. I took a seat in the back row, and the president emeritus actually sat down next to me. So I'm watching Bradley speak, and then he just seems to drone on and on. It was called Meaning in American Politics. I suggested it was Dreaming in American Politics. He was talking about how capital follows knowledge and how we can reclaim the public sector as a venue for the source of our fulfillment. It just went on and on for 45 minutes. Then you know how in college lectures you see a head start to bob and then quickly jerk up and it bobs again down on the other side.
Yep.
I saw this start happening to one fellow, and then he seemed to be out cold. And then I hear what sounds alarming like a snore coming from next to me, and there's poor Father Hesburgh with letting loose his rather loud snore. Then you'd watch I'd see the kids in their fraternity jackets, their heads bobbing, and then Hesburgh snoring and Bradley droning on, and I was thinking that it was going to be an awfully long campaign.
Did you feel that that said something about the kind of president that Bradley would make?
Well, it absolutely did. And I think that pattern actually followed through the whole thing. Bradley could have been a very, very attractive candidate. He didn't want to lower himself to the level of actually communicating with Americans, though. He wanted to elevate the discourse, which I think is admirable, except that he was saying to people, I'm better than you, I'm going to speak on this higher plane, I'm going to elevate politics, and if you don't like it, then don't come with me. And that was what it became, is the sense that he was sanctimonious, that he was aloof, that he thought he was better than everybody else, and people didn't like him as a result of that. You could see that repeat itself throughout the campaign. The whole idea was that he was going to tell us things that we did not want to hear, which of course is a unique form of pandering, in which you say, in which you sort of flatter the voter by saying, you really do want to hear this. I think highly of you because I think you can listen to these hard truths I have to tell you about America. That may work with some folks. In fact, I think in that very same article, I said it probably works very well with the National Public Radio crowd. But unfortunately, Terry, that's not yet a majority of the American public.
Hey, we all thank you for that compliment, huh? Yeah. You tell a funny story about Karen Hughes. She's somebody we saw a lot of during the Florida recount when she was a spokesperson for George W. Bush. Now she's one of his most highly placed aides, and we'll be seeing a lot more of her. Mm-hmm. This is a story having to do with shoes. Why don't you tell it for us?
It is, and this, and you have to understand Karen Hughes first. She's a very tall, sturdily built woman, and she inspires fear in not only journalists but probably anybody whom she meets. And she is fiercely loyal to Bush. She is on message to the extent that I'm sure if you woke her up in the middle of the night, she would read you from paragraph 3 of the press release on the Bush tax plan. We were actually standing right outside of from the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia one day. I had pool duty, which means you represent the press and then report back to all your colleagues. And there were just a few of us standing there, and we'd remarked that she had such nice purple shoes on. And she told a story that changed my impression of her forever. She said, "You know, I have to tell you how I got these. She had a size 10 or a size 12. So I'm not very good with women's shoe sizes, but it was anyway a very large size shoe. And she says she lived in Austin. She said she had to go to Dallas to get shoes because all she could get are the, you know, usual white or black shoe there in Austin. Then she found this one store that was selling shoes of all varieties and colors and in her size, and she bought a whole bunch and asked the fellow, "You know, I usually have to go to Dallas. How come you have these?" And so she said, "Well, we stock these for the transvestites." And which I thought the idea of saying that in a self-deprecating way changed my view of her entirely. And I reported this faithfully back to the press corps and said that, you know, you're on your own if you want to report about this. I didn't report about it in a news story. It wasn't quite newsworthy, but I think it helps us now to understand Karen Hughes, and it says that, you know, behind this press release machine, there's actually something of a wry and funny person, and that bodes well for America.
I want to get back to what you were saying, that during this campaign, there seemed, if anything, to be a conservative bias in the press and an anti-Gore bias. I want to know what makes you say that, and also why you think that was, what accounts for it.
Sure. Right. The tradition is to say that it's the liberal media that's always going to come around for their guy in the end. The truth is the press corps covering Bush liked their candidate a great deal more than the press corps covering Gore. Now, some of this is just driven by you want to back the winner, so that if you think your guy is on top, he'll get the best coverage. And you could see that when Gore in the late summer swung ahead in the polls, the coverage immediately shifted, and suddenly Bush couldn't catch a break. So some of that was simply poll-driven and the idea that journalists want to back a winner. But I think if you look at the whole thing from beginning to end, you'll see that the coverage from the journalists covering Gore was much tougher and much more skeptical about the man than the coverage of Bush. It sort of set the tone by what was nicknamed the Spice Girls. There were three journalists, women from the Associated Press, from the New York Times, and from the Washington Post on the Gore campaign. And the criticism, I don't think it was entirely fair, but the criticism was that they just really didn't like this guy, and it was going to be everything he did was suspect. It was always about the hidden motives behind what he was doing. Whereas on the other side, you had the Bush coverage. These people genuinely seemed to like the man. They didn't get into all this question of motive. They didn't get into all the questions of what was behind it, what he was really trying to say, or the style in which he was saying it. They were actually taking his words and writing them. And I think if you look in the overall, this is the pattern throughout the campaign. And I think it's because, by and large, Bush was much better at winning over journalists individually. Not as good as John McCain was, but he was a lot better than Al Gore was. This changed time to time through the campaign. Bush became very close to the press when he was in trouble right after New Hampshire. Gore went through brief periods when he'd spent a lot of time on the back of the plane. But both of them would go through periods when the press was actually counting. You know, it's been 47 days without a press availability. And that began to cloud everything else, and you just get this ornery group of journalists who hasn't seen this man that they've been traveling with for a month. They haven't literally spoken with him in that period of time. And that has to influence the coverage. And I think all of that influences the coverage more than some sort of ideological bias that journalists may have.
Well, is a personality bias any better than, I mean, like if a candidate is nice to the press and if they have a nice sense of humor, is that a good reason for them to get better coverage and to be treated more favorably?
Is it a good reason? No, I'm not arguing that it's a good reason. As I said, I don't think it's a terribly flattering portrayal of my of myself and my colleagues. Mm-hmm. That if somebody's going to feed us donuts and good barbecue, he's going to get good stories. That's obviously, I'm exaggerating there to an extent, but that is, I think there is something to that. I suppose if you were trying to create some sort of elaborate justification for that, you could say that a candidate who is strong interpersonally, who can win people over, is the more effective leader. That if you look at the more pious and sanctimonious presidents we've had, they tend to be the weaker ones, and the ones who are quite skilled at getting along with people and negotiating are the better ones. We don't want to have another Woodrow Wilson, which I think we would have had with Bill Bradley. The fact that everybody who meets President-elect Bush seems to like him certainly weighs in his favor. Now, I realize I'm sort of rationalizing there. In reality, it's just because we've been given donuts. But there's probably a little bit of a lesson for journalists and for politicians in that.
Dana Milbank, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dana Milbank is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book about life on the campaign trail is called Smash Mouth. Soul singer James Carr died of cancer on Sunday in Memphis, where he lived most of his life. He was 58. Let's listen to his best-known recording, Dark End of the Street, which was written by Dan Penn and Chips Moman. In 1966, this made it to the top 10 of the rhythm and blues chart.
At the dark end of the street, that's where we always meet, hiding in shadows where we don't belong, living in darkness to hide our wrong. You and me at the dark end of the street. You. I know time's gonna take its toll. We have to pay for the love we stole. It's a sin and we know it's wrong. Oh, but our love keeps coming on strong. Still away to the dark. Of the street.
That was James Carr. He died Sunday of cancer. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Mole and Temptation Island. This is Fresh Air. Among the first new TV shows of the year are three series trying to follow on the heels of last season's smash hit Survivor. ABC has The Mole, which premiered last night, and Fox has Temptation Island, which first airs tonight. And the WB network has Pop Stars coming up on Friday. TV critic David Bianculli says the copycats are inevitable and that their failure probably is too.
Why are we suddenly getting hit with all these reality shows and cutthroat contests in primetime? Two reasons: Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and the threatened actors' strike later this year. Millionaire burst out of the gate two summers ago and changed all the rules. At a time when network viewership was going down, Regis Philbin's quiz show proved that broadcast TV still could attract large audiences and entertain several generations at once, like it did way back in the years B.C., before cable. Because of Millionaire, network executives were ready to try almost anything. One of those tries resulted in Survivor, last year's biggest new hit. The other reason for all this new reality show development is that all of Hollywood is fearing, and gearing up for, a possible actors' strike later this year. For TV, that means scripted shows will have to be stockpiled in advance or substituted with other programs. And these reality shows, like news magazines, are the most obvious players to call in from the bench. That doesn't mean, though, that any of them are worth watching, or that any of them will succeed. Look, I liked Millionaire and Survivor from the start, and predicted both would be big hits. The predictions coming true was dumb luck. It always is. But I reacted to those shows, like many people did, because they were so different. Millionaire was the first primetime quiz show in decades, and Survivor was a true TV original. That's why I think they succeeded, and why I think The Mole, Temptation Island, and Pop Stars, like last season's Survivor wannabe Big Brother, will fail. So will most of the third-generation copies due later this season. When Millionaire hit big on ABC, Fox broke a TV development speed record churning out its own game show ripoff. That show was called Greed, and really, the title says it all about this entire copycat phenomenon. Except in this case, Gordon Gekko's advice in the movie Wall Street didn't hold true. Greed was not good. The only thing more pathetic about the way TV tries to clone its own successes is how long it's been trying the same sorry trick. Half a century ago, when the first Western showed up in TV's top 10, the networks fell all over themselves churning out variations on the same cowboy themes. By the end of the 1950s, there were 31 Westerns in primetime every week, and many of them were weak. Every time someone on TV scores a big hit, other people are there ready to try the sincerest form of flattery. In the 70s, anyone with a pulse could host a variety show. In the 80s, The Cosby Show and Miami Vice were followed by several sad, inferior imitators. And now, to start this new century, we have stuff like Pop Stars, which tracks the tryouts for a brand new girl group, and Temptation Island, which takes four unmarried couples, separates them, and tempts them with good-looking people in a show that's less steamy and even less interesting than it sounds. And The Mole, which gathers 10 people together and eliminates them one by one with the help of one inside person who's actually working against the others. Here's a quick taste of The Mole just to prove how insipid it is. The contestants are gathered around a conference room table, and host Anderson Cooper is about to show them a videotape catching them in the act of doing something they shouldn't have done.
Oh, and one more thing. As I left this room, I told you as a group not to discuss anything you had seen on the monitors. You all come around, look at this.
During the test, we'd had our camera crew step out of the room. But one camera was left recording to see if the players would discuss the information on the screens when they thought no one was listening.
Have you never had your heart broken?
Never had.
He said, have you never ever had your heart broken,
Charlie? And Charlie answered, and because of that, we're going to have to penalize you $10,000.
Who said that?
I just don't know.
This is a show built entirely around distrust. A show where cameras are everywhere and the results are intended for national television. Knowing that, what kinds of idiots would think they have any sort of privacy at all? These kinds of idiots, that's who. And to tell you the truth, I can't work up much more sympathy for anyone who wants to watch one of these tacky-come-latelys. Pop Stars doesn't interest me, I don't dig The Mole, and Temptation Island doesn't tempt me a bit. But I still watch Millionaire from time to time, and when Survivor 2 premieres after the Super Bowl, I'll be there.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from jazz pianist Uri Kane's new CD of his interpretation of the Goldberg Variations. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Dell Paperbacks Division, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer, with updated listings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as George W. Bush prepares to move into the White House, we talk about life in the Clinton White House, with Clinton's former campaign strategist and political advisor Paul Vigala and former budget director and chief of staff Leon Panetta. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.